Welcome, Dumbheads, to MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. In this series, we are examining every single goddamn page of Palladium's Beyond the Supernatural RPG to determine what is the dumbest thing on that page. Every episode is one page, every episode is short. If you'd like to play along at home, this is Beyond the Supernatural 2nd Edition, the first printing from January 2005. Today we're discussing page 160 of Beyond the Supernatural. We're continuing to move through the combat section, which started a couple of days ago, but we've been doing the Z-Files. So we're picking this up in the middle of the action. We've already had the basics of the combat system described. Roll to strike, roll to defend, roll to damage. Combat proceeds to the other combatant until one character's actions per melee are expended, at which point all the other combatants' actions happen in sequence without interruption. Fortunately, as you can tell from that little snippet, we don't really have to talk about any of that. This page is commentary, and I haven't always been kind to the commentary in this book, but this is a place where we really needed to know some things that have never been addressed before in a book that we've looked at. Most notably, longtime listeners will know this, but let's catch up the newbies. Most notably, Palladium combat does not deal with multiple combatants well. It treats every encounter as a boxing match, and when there are more than two people, which is not the way that a standard boxing match operates. I understand. I'm more of a pro wrestling person, and pro wrestling matches can have any number of participants, including rarely zero. But in a boxing match, typically you've got one-on-one for a total of two boxers. Naturally, this doesn't work great in a group setting in a role-playing game, and so, implicitly or explicitly, Palladium games have tended to treat an entire RPG combat as a bunch of separate boxing matches, one-on-one fights, between pairs of characters. When I talk about the boxing fairy on the podcast, what I'm typically talking about is this little voice that seems to exist, whispering to the author over his shoulder, getting him to turn every rule system, however inappropriate, into fundamentally a boxing match. But the boxing fairy, though her magic is vast, she needs you to find the magic within yourself to make the all-boxing paradigm work. And up until now, Palladium Games have not provided the guidance for us to do that. Today, at last, there's a section headed, quote, spreading out combat among several pairs of fighters. And when I read it, there was a giddiness that washed over my body. He's finally going to talk about it, I said. I clenched my hands girlishly at my chin. I hopped. My pigtails, had I pigtails, would have bounced. I was so excited. Because up to now, the author has just treated this like it's not a problem. But clearly, like, if a villain is going to behead one of the player characters, and all the other player characters are standing around watching it, one of them is going to have the bright idea. Hey, my guy's on the ropes that I'm fighting. Why don't I run over there and stop that from happening? Why am I playing by Marcus of Queensberry rules in the negative zone? I can just run over there and interfere. It's going to come up constantly, and the author has just not acknowledged that problem. But here is an acknowledgement. And it starts with another notable acknowledgement. Quote, most gaming groups have 3 to 6 players, all of whom are likely to be matched up against their own adversary at the same time. That's 3 to 6 pairs of fighters in the same melee round. The author is now on the record as admitting that most gaming groups will be about 3 to 6 players, not 26 problem gamers locked in a rec center, huddled around a table for 14 hours overnight. It's 3 to 6 players typically. So that's acknowledgement number one. Number two, there's a question about what to do when all these characters start to interact in a way that is not so neat. Now, the author's first suggestion, or rather assumption, is just they're all going to be paired off. It's going to be one villain with one hero. So the question is, do we do one pair and complete that pair and then move on to the next pair? You know, one boxing match to the next? Or how do we do this? And the author says, no, that's boring. Quote, instead, I hop from one set of combatants to the other, trying to leave the most dramatic or decisive clash for last. This means I let the first villain and player character take a whack or two at each other, i.e. one or two melee attacks, or say something like, okay, you guys are going at it hot and heavy, or you're holding your own for now. Then I turn to the next player and give him a turn. The madman you're facing screams and charges. What do you do? Inevitably, he parries or strikes or dodges, and his combat is engaged. I let two melee attacks unfold, put him on pause, and turn to the next player and repeat. End quote. So this is like 101 level. Because we've decided to have a combat system where everybody has to pair off and everybody gets multiple actions per round, maybe don't run the whole exchange between a pair of people all at once. Everybody else is going to get bored. Be a director. Do some intercutting. Which I want to emphasize, this may seem like basic advice to experienced GMs, but in fact, as is so often the case in Palladium books, when the author departs from game design and gets to GMing tips, he is insightful and his advice is normally good. The author is a good GM, and this is good advice. You've got to keep in mind the player's experience of what's happening at the table, the story that is unfolding. Just like telling a story, it's not just a list of events described as succinctly or clearly as possible. The order and style of presentation, building suspense, paying off tension, that is a storyteller's job. It's a director's job. And it's part of the GM's job to order the events of the cooperative narrative in such a way that they create not only a conceptually or logically satisfying chain of events, but a narratively and dramatically interesting flow of narrative at the table. But before I go too far down this road of complimenting the author on his GMing, the author is a strong entertainer as a GM, is the sense that I get. There's another aspect to GMing, which is the sort of social facilitator, referee aspect, the part that's about your relationship to the people at the table. And the author definitely comes from that school of thought that when people come to your table for D&D, you're basically topping them, and not like in a scarf way, in like a hot wax way, in a crop way. You're in charge. You're going to show them a good time by taking charge. And that's the direction that the rest of this section goes when it broaches the subject of, oh, well, what if the players and the player characters decide, you know, fuck all these separate boxing matches. Let's mix it up. What if they try to break down the elegant perfection of the Palladium combat system by trying to all be in the action scene at once? Here's the answer, and it's framed as advice on creating tension and creating a cliffhanger. Quote, use this pause, switch, return method along with cliffhanger suspense and try to build to a satisfying climax. For example, as one of the free player characters, having vanquished his adversary, looks on, he sees one of his teammates losing his fight. Things look bad. The free character tells the game master that he is running over to help his buddy, or taking aim at his buddy's opponent. The GM says, okay, but seems to otherwise ignore him, or says something like, okay, you're charging over there or taking aim, but in the meanwhile, that's right, the advice is to ignore the player who's trying to run over there and help. Treat him like he's asking for his $20 back and you're a little light right now. Just duck him. What do you do while you're ducking him? What do you look away from him to? Why? The beleaguered player character, of course, to lay in some more kicks. Quote, the GM turns to the player whose character is under brutal attack and faring poorly. The GM allows another exchange between the villain slash monster and the beleaguered player character. After all, one melee attack and counterattack takes only 2 or 3 seconds. Only 2 or 3 seconds. Having short rounds means it's always plausible to say, okay, but there's another attack before you get to do anything. You over there saying my character does this, okay, but not in the next 2 seconds, surely. Doesn't it take you a second or two to draw your weapon? Doesn't it take you a second or two to get your bearings? Just cool your jets. You're not in the scene yet. But you gotta do it fast. You gotta fast talk them. You gotta hustle them. Because if you don't, they may well ask, well, yeah, but I just had a whole exchange of like 5 or 6 actions in my melee round, and I got to fire my gun every one of them, right? Like I get to fire my gun and the next turn, I get to fire it again. So it's my turn now. The turn is passed. Can't I fire? Isn't that how fast I normally fire? You gotta shut them down. You gotta look away. Pretend you smell something burning, whatever you need to do, because you can't let the player on to the secret truth, the actual physics of the Palladium combat system, which is when you finish up with your individual boxing match, either because you won it or because you left it to go do something else, you essentially fall into a time vortex. Time and space outside of the context of a boxing match is just real hazy in the Palladium system. Who knows how long it could take you to run over to interfere in someone else's fist fight? You could be there next turn, maybe next round, maybe a couple of minutes from now, maybe never. Maybe never. Their whole boxing match might resolve before you get there. Even if this is Heroes Unlimited and you run like 800 miles an hour, doesn't matter. When you leave a one-on-one confrontation, you are out of bounds, you fall off of Rainbow Road, and Lakitu, played here by the GM, will fish you out and bring you back up when he is goddamn good and ready. So let's assume you can fast talk your players not to notice this, and you can keep putting them off, selectively ignoring them, whatever. What is this meant to look like if all goes well? Quote, if played out right, the free character is shouting, I leap at the villain, or I strike with my sword, or I shoot. But the GM, still looking at the beleaguered character, says, the villain, caught in a blood fever, doesn't see or hear the free character. Much like me, much like how I can't see Paul, who is right next to me, screaming, it's my turn, I want to go. I can't see him and neither can the villain. Quote, all he can think about is finishing you off. He raises his clawed hand, or takes aim, or whatever, and ... And that's when the GM turns to the free character and says, roll to strike. Cool, huh? Very dramatic. End quote. I mean, it's dramatic. It's dramatic because you rigged it. And the success of this tactic is just going to depend on how perceptive your players are, and how slick you are. You know, this is the thing that beginning players and GMs often don't realize. You make a lot of judgment calls like this. The stealth roll to get into the secret facility, you know, the bad guy is arming the bomb, They're about to shoot the hostages, whatever. You're sneaking in there. Do you make one stealth roll? And then that determines if you're inside or not. And then we just move on. Or do you make a series of stealth rolls? And there's a scene there. You've been hurled off a cliff, but you managed to cling to the side. Do you make one climb roll to scramble back up and get right back into that sword fight? That's like one spot in the fight, is that you get hurled off the cliff and then flip yourself end over end back up, rapier in hand. Or do you make a series of tense climb checks as the rest of the combat rages around you, trying desperately to elbow yourself back up from the brink of death before either your grip slips and you fall, or your foes win the sword fight and come stomp on your hands and finish you off last? It totally depends on what the scene is and what the drama of the situation demands. That's not something you find in a rule book. That pacing, it's a GM decision. And normally that's pretty seamless, but when your boy Paul is over here screaming, "I shoot, I shoot," and the GM is just like avoiding eye contact with him, like, somebody hear something? I feel like I hear someone talking about combat. Oh, it must be your deadly foe talking about combat. He's beating the shit out of you. Roll to strike, kick in the ribs, roll to strike, kick in the ribs, roll to strike, kick in the teeth this time. You weren't expecting it. Double damage. Ha 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 ha. And meanwhile, Paul's like, "Am I there yet? Am I there? I got my knife out and my gun. I throw the knife. I shoot. I'm running over too. Is my gun jammed? What's going on?" It is impossible for everyone not to notice that time is being bent around Paul. And this undermines the drama of the situation because it's so clearly rigged. Like, if Paul could fire his goddamn weapon like he wants to, like he's screaming about, we wouldn't have a problem here. The evil foe would have been dropped before kick to the ribs number one. We all could have moved on with our lives. The only reason those kicks to the ribs landed is because the GM is determinedly avoiding Paul. He is pocket vetoing everything Paul is trying to do to ratchet up the tension. But in so doing, he's pulled back the curtain. He's exposed too much. The players now know this scene is going to go the way the GM wants it to go. He wants this villain to be menacing, therefore it doesn't matter what any of us do. We can't shoot an arrow with this guy. We can't run up and stab him. Nobody's doing anything to this villain until our poor beleaguered teammate is on the brink of death with one intact rib left to his name. Only then will the GM allow a hit to land on this villain. And while that would be a very dramatic situation if it emerged organically, if it ever becomes clear that the GM is forcing it to happen, the tension is lost. It's like in pro wrestling, right? If you can immerse yourself in the storyline, then when bad guys do bad things, or a hero seems to be in danger of losing, the heat is on the villain. But if the cheating is ever too blatant, or the needs of the writers and producers of the show ever become too obvious to the viewer, then it ruins the whole effect because the heat isn't on the villain. The heat is on the referee, or the heat is on the writer. And in this case, the heat would be on the GM. I'm not pissed at Mingo the Malevolent for kicking the shit out of my midsection. I'm pissed at you, the GM, because everybody here has got a bullet locked and loaded for Mingo, and the only reason nobody's fired yet is because you've predetermined that this combat needs to end a certain way. There's that fine line. Like, for me, I'm not a big advocate of illusionism in gaming, which, for those who don't read too much RPG theory online, basically the idea is it's a situation where you create an illusion of uncertainty, unpredictability, player agency, or world simulation, or whatever, but really, it doesn't exist. The classic example is where there's a bit of treasure or a clue you want the player characters to find, and you've just decided it's going to be behind the second door they open in the sprawling dungeon. The illusion of chance, the illusion of meaningful choice, but it was always going to be behind the second door, no matter what they did. Some people love illusionism. I'm not a huge fan of it. Regardless, we can all agree there's something on this side of illusionism where there are real player choices and there is real integrity to the fictional world, so that choices are real and meaningful, even if potentially not very entertaining. Then there's something on the other end of illusionism where the illusion breaks down, and at some point you get that palpable shared feeling. Oh, we all understand that the GM's already decided how this works out, even though he's pretending we can affect it, so let's just sit back and let him do it. I feel like the author's advice here is going to leave a bad taste in Paul's mouth after he's been yelling for 15 minutes to try to get into the action. And that's the dumbest thing on this page. This advice to literally just ignore players who are trying to interfere with the tense, dramatic situation you're trying to create by taking their turn, just by guys pretending you don't hear them or pretending you forgot what they said. That's some hokey shit. It's a very carny GM tip. So yeah, that's the dumbest thing. Anyway, the combat section continues next time. Do join me next time for the return of another beloved feature from seasons past on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This has been Mega Dumbcast. New episodes drop every day except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big megasode on the top-secret Patreon-only RSS feed. If you'd like to get access to that RSS feed and support the show, go to patreon.com/megadumbcast. Contact or check out the show wherever you want. I am Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, Podbean, your favorite podcatcher, etc., etc. MDC, Palladium Books, Beyond the Supernatural, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Zambita. This season's theme song is Horizon Ending by Soft and Furious, whose work you can find at loyaltyfreakmusic.com. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.